click on the ad brings in a quarter, 50 cents, or even a dollar or two. That's a success. Naturally, the lead generator also makes money, and so it looks as though the system is functioning efficiently. The wheels of commerce are turning. Yet from society's perspective, a simple hunt for government services puts a big target on the back of poor people, leading a certain number of them towards false promises and high-interest loans. Even considered strictly from an economic point of view, it's a drain on the system. The fact that people need food stamps in the first place represents a failing of the market economy. The government, using tax dollars, attempts to compensate for it with the hope that food stamp recipients will eventually be able to fully support themselves. But the lead aggregators push them toward needless transactions, leaving a good number of them with larger deficits and even more dependent on public assistance. The WMD, while producing revenue for search engines, lead aggregators, and marketers, is a leech on the economy as a whole. A regulatory system for WMDs would have to measure such hidden costs, while also incorporating a host of non-numerical values. This is already the case for other types of regulation. Though economists may attempt to calculate costs for smog or agricultural runoff, or the extinction of the spotted owl, numbers can never express their value. And the same is often true of fairness and the common good in mathematical models. They're concepts that reside only in the human mind, and they resist quantification. And since humans are in charge of making the models, they rarely go the extra mile or two to even try. It's just considered too difficult. But we need to impose human values on these systems, even at the cost of efficiency. For example, a model might be programmed to make sure that various ethnicities or income levels are represented within groups of voters or consumers. Or it could highlight cases in which people in certain zip codes pay twice the average for certain services. These approximations may be crude, especially at first, but they're essential. Mathematical models should be our tools, not our masters. The achievement gap, mass incarceration, and voter apathy are big nationwide problems that no free market nor mathematical algorithm will fix. So the first step is to get a grip on our techno-utopia, that unbounded and unwarranted hope in what algorithms and technology can accomplish. Before asking them to do better, we have to admit they can't do everything. To disarm WMDs, we also need to measure their impact and conduct algorithmic audits. The first step, before digging into the software code, is to carry out research. We'd begin by treating the WMD as a black box that takes in data and spits out conclusions. This person has a medium risk of committing another crime. This one has a 73% chance of voting Republican. This teacher ranks in the lowest decile. By studying these outputs, we could piece together the assumption behind the model and score them for fairness. Sometimes it is all too clear from the get-go that certain WMDs are only primitive tools, which hammer complexity into simplicity, making it easier for managers to fire groups of people or to offer discounts to others. The value-added model used in New York public schools, for example, the one that rated Tim Clifford a disastrous 6 1 year and then a high-flying 96 a year later, is a statistical farce. If you plot year-to-year scores on a chart, the dots are nearly as randomly placed as hydrogen atoms in a room. Many of the math students in those very schools could study the statistics for 15 minutes and conclude with confidence that the scores measure nothing. Good teachers, after all, tend to be good 1 year after the next. Unlike, say, relief pitchers in baseball, they rarely have great seasons followed by disasters. And also unlike relief pitchers, their performance resists quantitative analysis. There's no fixing a backward model like the value-added model. The only solution in such a case is to ditch the unfair system. Forget, at least for the next decade or two, about building tools to measure the effectiveness of a teacher. It's too complex to model, and the only available data are crude proxies. The model is simply not good enough yet to inform important decisions about the people we trust to teach our children. That's a job that requires subtlety and context. Even in the age of big data, it remains a problem for humans to solve. Of course, the human analysts, whether the principal or administrators, should consider lots of data, including the students' test scores. They should incorporate positive feedback loops. These are the angelic cousins of the pernicious feedback loops we've come to know so well. A positive loop simply provides information to the data scientist or to the automatic system so that the model can be improved. In this case, it's simply a matter of asking teachers and students alike if the evaluations make sense for them, if they understand and accept the premises behind them. If not, how could they be enhanced? Only when we have an ecosystem with positive feedback loops can we expect to improve teaching using data. Until then, it's just punitive. It is true, as data boosters are quick to point out, that the human brain runs internal models of its own, and they're often tinged with prejudice or self-interest. So its outputs, in this case, teacher evaluations, must also be audited for fairness. And these audits have to be carefully designed and tested by human beings, and afterward automated. In the meantime, mathematicians can get to work on devising models to help teachers measure their own effectiveness and improve. Other audits are far more complicated. Take the criminal recidivism models that judges in many states consult before sentencing prisoners. In these cases, since the technology is fairly new, we have a before and an after. Have judges' sentencing patterns changed since they started receiving risk analysis from the WMD? We'll see, no doubt, that a number of the judges ran similarly troubling models in their heads long before the software arrived, punishing poor prisoners and minorities more severely than others. In some of those cases, conceivably, the software might temper their judgments, in others not. But with enough data, patterns will become clear, allowing us to evaluate the strength and the tilt of the WMD. If we find, as studies have already shown, that the recidivism models codify prejudice and penalize the poor, then it's time to take a look at the inputs. In this case, they include loads of birds of a feather connections. They predict an individual's behavior on the basis of the people he knows, his job, and his credit rating, details that would be inadmissible in court. The fairness fix is to throw out that data. But wait, many would say, are we going to sacrifice the accuracy of the model for fairness? Do we have to dumb down our algorithms? In some cases, yes. If we're going to be equal before the law, or be treated equally as voters, we cannot stand for systems that drop us into different castes and treat us differently. You might think that an even-handed audit would push to eliminate variables such as race from the analysis, but if we're going to measure the impact of a WMD, we need that data. Currently, most of the WMDs avoid directly tracking race. In many cases, it's against the law. It is easier, however, to expose racial discrimination in mortgage lending than in auto loans, because mortgage lenders are required to ask for the race of the applicant, while auto lenders are not. If we include race in the analysis, as the computer scientist Cynthia Dwork has noted, we can quantify racial injustice where we find it. Then, we can publicize it, debate the ethics, and propose remedies. Having said that, race is a social construct, and as such is difficult to pin down even when you intend to, as any person of mixed race can tell you. Companies like Amazon and Netflix can plunk their paying customers into little buckets and optimize them all they want, but the same algorithm cannot deliver justice or democracy. Movements toward auditing algorithms are already afoot. At Princeton, for example, researchers have launched the Web Transparency and Accountability Project. They create software robots that masquerade online as people of all stripes, rich, poor, male, female, or suffering from mental health issues. By studying the treatment these robots receive, the academics can detect biases in automated systems from search engines to job placement sites. Similar initiatives are taking root at universities like Carnegie Mellon and MIT. Academic support for these initiatives is crucial. After all, to police the WMDs, we need people with the skills to build them. Their research tools can replicate the immense scale of the WMDs and retrieve datasets large enough to reveal the imbalances and injustice embedded in the models. They can also build crowdsourcing campaigns so that people across society can provide details on the messaging they're receiving from advertisers or politicians. This could illuminate the practices and strategies of micro-targeting campaigns. Not all of them would turn out to be nefarious. Following the 2012 presidential election, for example, ProPublica built what it called a message machine, which used crowdsourcing to reverse engineer the model for the Obama campaign's targeted political ads. Different groups, as it turned out, heard glowing remarks about the president from different celebrities, each one presumably targeted for a specific audience. This was no smoking gun. But by providing information and eliminating the mystery behind the model, the message machine reduced, if only by a tad, grounds for dark rumors and suspicion. That's a good thing. If you consider mathematical models as the engines of the digital economy, and in many ways they are, these auditors are opening the hoods, showing us how they work. This is a vital step, so that we can equip these powerful engines with steering wheels and brakes. Auditors face resistance, however, often from the web giants, which are the closest thing we have to information utilities. Google, for example, has prohibited researchers from creating scores of fake profiles in order to map the biases of the search engine. Google has expressed interest in working to eliminate bias from its algorithm, and some Google employees briefly talked to me about this. One of the first things I tell them is to open the platform to more outside researchers. If the company does in fact carry out bias audits, its preference is to keep them internal. That way they shield the algorithm's inner workings and its prejudices from outsiders. But insiders, suffering as we all do from confirmation bias, are more likely to see what they expect to find. They might not ask the most probing questions. And if they find injustices that appear to boost Google's bottom line, well, that could lead to uncomfortable discussions, ones they'd certainly want to keep out of the public light. So there are powerful business arguments for secrecy. But as the public learns more about WMDs and demands more accountability from these utilities, Google, I'm hoping, will have little choice but to let outsiders in. Facebook too. The social network's rigorous policy to tie users to their real names severely limits the research outsiders can carry out there. The real name policy is admirable in many ways, not least because it pushes users to be accountable for the messages they post. But Facebook also must be accountable to all of us, which means opening its platform to more data auditors. The government, of course, has a powerful regulatory role to play, just as it did when confronted with the excesses and tragedies of the first industrial revolution. It can start by adapting and then enforcing the laws that are already on the books. As we discussed in the chapter on credit scores, the civil rights laws referred to as the Fair Credit Reporting Act, FCRA, and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, ECOA, were meant to ensure fairness in credit scoring. The FCRA guarantees that a consumer can see the data going into their score and correct any errors, and the ECOA prohibits linking race or gender to a person's score. These regulations are not perfect, and they desperately need updating. Consumer complaints are often ignored, and there's nothing explicitly keeping credit scoring companies from using zip codes as proxies for race. Still, they offer a good starting point. First, we need to demand transparency. Each of us should have the right to receive an alert when a credit score is being used to judge or vet us, and each of us should have access to the information being used to compute that score. If it is incorrect, we should have the right to challenge and correct it. Next, the regulations should expand to cover new types of credit companies like LendingClub, which use newfangled e-scores to predict the risk that will default on loans. They should not be allowed to operate in the shadows. The Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, which protects people with medical issues from being discriminated against at work, also needs an update. The bill currently prohibits medical exams as part of an employment screening, but we need to update it to take into account big data personality tests, health scores, and reputation scores. They all sneak around the law, and they shouldn't be able to. One possibility already under discussion would extend protection of the ADA to include predicted health outcomes down the road. In other words, if a genome analysis shows that a person has a high risk for breast cancer or for Alzheimer's, that person should not be denied job opportunities. We must also expand the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, which protects our medical information in order to cover the medical data currently being collected by employers, health apps, and other big data companies. Any health-related data collected by brokers such as Google searches for medical treatments must also be protected. If we want to bring out the big guns, we might consider moving toward the European model, which stipulates that any data collected must be approved by the user as an opt-in. It also prohibits the reuse of data for other purposes. The opt-in condition is all too often bypassed by having a user click on an inscrutable legal box. But the not reusable clause is very strong. It makes it illegal to sell user data. This keeps it from the data brokers whose dossiers feed toxic e-scores and micro-targeting campaigns. Thanks to this not reusable clause, the data brokers in Europe are much more restricted, assuming they follow the law. Finally, models that have a significant impact on our lives, including credit scores and e-scores, should be open and available to the public. Ideally, we could navigate them at the level of an app on our phones. In a tight month, for example, a consumer could use such an app to compare the impact of unpaid phone and electricity bills on her credit score and see how much a lower score would affect her plans to buy a car. The technology already exists. It's only the will we're lacking. On a summer day in 2013, I took the subway to the southern tip of Manhattan, and walked to a large administrative building across from New York's City Hall. I was interested in building mathematical models to help society, the opposite of WMDs. So I'd signed on as an unpaid intern in a data analysis group within the city's housing and human services departments. The number of homeless people in the city had grown to 64,000, including 22,000 children. My job was to help create a model that would predict how long a homeless family would stay in the shelter system, and to pair each family with the appropriate services. The idea was to give people what they needed to take care of themselves and their families and to find a permanent home. My job, in many ways, was to help come up with a recidivism model. Much like the analysts building the LSIR model, I was interested in the forces that pushed people back to shelters and also those that led them to stable housing. Unlike the sentencing WMD, though, our small group was concentrating on using these findings to help the victims and to reduce homelessness and despair. The goal was to create a model for the common good. On a separate but related project, one of the other researchers had found an extremely strong correlation, one that pointed to a solution. A certain group of homeless families tended to disappear from shelters and never return. These were the ones who had been granted vouchers under a federal affordable housing program called Section 8. This shouldn't have been too surprising. If you provide homeless families with affordable housing, not too many of them will opt for the streets or squalid shelters. Yet that conclusion might have been embarrassing to then-Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his administration. With much fanfare, the city government had moved to wean families from Section 8. It instituted a new system called Advantage, which limited subsidies to 3 years. The idea was that the looming expiration of their benefits would push poor people to make more money and pay their own way. This proved optimistic, as the data made clear. Meanwhile, New York's booming real estate market was driving up rents, making the transition even more daunting. Families without Section 8 vouchers streamed back into the shelters. The researcher's finding was not welcome. For a meeting with important public officials, our group prepared a PowerPoint presentation about homelessness in New York. After the slide with statistics about recidivism and the effectiveness of Section 8 was put up, an extremely awkward and brief conversation took place. Someone demanded the slide be taken down. The party line prevailed. While big data, when managed wisely, can provide important insights, many of them will be disruptive. After all, it aims to find patterns that are invisible to human eyes. The challenge for data scientists is to understand the ecosystems they are wading into, and to present not just the problems, but also their possible solutions. A simple workflow data analysis might highlight 5 workers who appear to be superfluous. But if the data team brings in an expert, they might help discover a more constructive version of the model. It might suggest jobs these people could fill in an optimized system and might identify the training they'd need to fill those positions. Sometimes the job of a data scientist is to know when you don't know enough. As I survey the data economy, I see loads of emerging mathematical models that might be used for good and an equal number that have the potential to be great if they're not abused. Consider the work of Mira Bernstein, a slavery sleuth. A Harvard PhD in math, she created a model to scan vast industrial supply chains, like the ones that put together cell phones, sneakers, or SUVs, to find signs of forced labor. She built her slavery model for a nonprofit company called Made in a Free World. Its goal is to use the model to help companies root out the slave-built components in their products. The idea is that companies will be eager to free themselves from this scourge, presumably because they oppose slavery, but also because association with it could devastate their brand. Bernstein collected data from a number of sources, including trade data from the United Nations, statistics about the regions where slavery was most prevalent, and detailed information about the components going into thousands of industrial products, and incorporated it all into a model that could score a given product from a certain region for the likelihood that it was made using slave labor. The idea is that the user would contact his supplier and say, "Tell me more about where you're getting the following parts of your computers," Bernstein told Wired magazine. Like many responsible models, the slavery detector does not overreach. It merely points to suspicious places and leaves the last part of the hunt to human beings. Some of the companies find no doubt that the suspected supplier is legit. Every model produces false positives. That information comes back to Made in a Free World, where Bernstein can study the feedback. Another model for the common good has emerged in the field of social work. It's a predictive model that pinpoints households where children are most likely to suffer abuse. The model, developed by Eckerd, a Child and Family Services nonprofit in the southeastern United States, launched in 2013 in Florida's Hillsborough County, an area encompassing Tampa. In the previous 2 years, 9 children in the area had died from abuse, including a baby who was thrown out a car window. The modelers included 1,500 child abuse cases in their database, including the fatalities. They found a number of markers for abuse, including a boyfriend in the home, a record of drug use or domestic violence, and a parent who had been in foster care as a child. If this were a program to target potential criminals, you can see right away how unfair it could be. Having lived in a foster home or having an unmarried partner in the house should not be grounds for suspicion. What's more, the model is much more likely to target the poor and to give a pass to potential abuse in wealthy neighborhoods. Yet, if the goal is not to punish the parents, but instead to provide help to children who might need it, a potential WMD turns benign. It funnels resources to families at risk. And in the 2 years following implementation of the model, according to the Boston Globe, Hillsborough County suffered no fatalities from child abuse. Models like this will abound in coming years, assessing our risk of osteoporosis or strokes, swooping in to help struggling students with Calculus II, even predicting the people most likely to suffer life-altering falls. Many of these models, like some of the WMDs we've discussed, will arrive with the best intentions. But they must also deliver transparency, disclosing the input data they're using as well as the results of their targeting. And they must be open to audits. These are powerful engines, after all. We must keep our eyes on them. Data is not going away, nor are computers, much less mathematics. Predictive models are increasingly the tools we will be relying on to run our institutions, deploy our resources, and manage our lives. But as I've tried to show throughout this audiobook, these models are constructed not just from data, but from the choices we make about which data to pay attention to and which to leave out. Those choices are not just about logistics, profits, and efficiency. They are fundamentally moral. If we back away from them and treat mathematical models as a neutral and inevitable force, like the weather or the tides, we abdicate our responsibility. And the result, as we've seen, is WMDs that treat us like machine parts in the workplace, that blackball employees and feast on inequities. We must come together to police these WMDs, to tame and disarm them. My hope is that they'll be remembered like the deadly coal mines of a century ago, as relics of the early days of this new revolution, before we learned how to bring fairness and accountability to the age of data. Math deserves much better than WMDs, and democracy does too. This is Kathy O'Neill. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. This program was directed and produced by Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 2016 by Kathy O'Neill. Production copyright 2016 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.